Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. It's your boy Limes here with another episode of Terror with the Twist of Limes. You've been listening to me or listening to the Ice Creams, podcasts and the videos that we've been putting out recently. You obviously know, I've made no secret of it. Everybody knows it is Women in Horror Month. And, we've been celebrating with, some of the greats there. We've been celebrating with, we had Emma Dark on the show. We've got Stacey Nelkin coming up. We've got Dee Wallace coming up. But tonight, I have a huge treat for you. Really big treat. A lady who is known, I would venture to say, by at least 98.5% of the horror population. And, before we get to talking to her, I'm going to kind of give you a few of her. She's got over 250 movie credits to her name. That's just acting, by the way. That's acting, nothing more. But let's go through some of these other accolades we've got down here. She was first runner-up on Joe Bob Briggs' 1996 Hubie Award for Best Actress in Abducted 2, The Reunion. She won the Barbarella Award for Best Actress in Broadcast Bombshells. And most recently, she was named one of the top 40 screen queens of the past 40 years by Entertainment Tonight. And that was on October 17th, 2018, she was named there. And you know and I know that, Scream Queens, the title Scream Queen, that is truly, that's the royalty of horror, especially in, obviously, the ladies working in the genre. But before we
get to
my guest.
She's here.
She's actually with us right now. So I would like to introduce, ladies and gentlemen, Debbie Rochon. Debbie, how are you?
I'm doing great. I heard part of the intro, and thank you guys so much. That's awesome. I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Beautiful.
Good.
Debbie, do you know what? I pride myself on transparency. So now that you're here, mm-hmm. I'm gonna fess up, hand on heart, to the audience. You probably noticed I spoke very, very slowly there. Let me explain why. Idiot boy gave Debbie the wrong number.
Yes.
I had to.
Debbie, I noticed that.
Bad lines.
Don't worry. Carl will make sure I'm suitably punished for that. Debbie,
thank you so much for joining us.
I'm
glad I got the last one came in. Okay. I was like, oh, that's a different number. Let me try that one. Okay, good. Glad I got you guys.
Beautiful. I'd like to introduce you, Debbie, to my co-host, Carl, who's with us tonight on the call. Say hi, Carl.
Hello, Debbie. I'm not only his co-host, but I'm also the sort of the grand poobah of the whole network. So it's really wonderful to have you with us, and we are very, very pleased and honored to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Carl. I'm very impressed. I get the honor to meet the grand poobah. And how often do you get that? So I thank you so much. You're amazing, Carl. Thank you for having this. Thank you for having me on the show.
And
thank
you
for having this empire that is amazing.
Hey, I'm not Swiss cheese over here, you know.
No, you're not. You're Terror with a Twist of Limes.
Debbie, there's honestly, I don't even know where to start. You're such a legend in the genre. So I guess probably the best place to start is at the beginning. You've obviously, you've made no secret of the fact that, you had a hard childhood. And as a child and into your teenage years, what I'd really like to know is what initially fired your sort of interest and your passion of the horror genre?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I grew up with, I would call them more cult films. And it wasn't until I had been working in a little bit of film before I moved to New York. So, in other words, I was doing extra work, right, as a preteen.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was studying a lot, and then I started getting movie roles. And then the one, then that's what happened. Then I found out after working and doing a number of student films in the early 80s, and, you know, the acting classes, all the plays that I worked on, and then starting to get into the film work, and send all of the sort of, like, quote, normal stuff that I was going up for, auditioning for in the early, mid-80s and stuff, and it was just, none of it was right, and I couldn't relate to it, and I wasn't, like, doing well, but I had so much to give, but so I realized that, okay, well, obviously all of this angst, crisis, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. that if I could harness that and use, you know, as they say, write what you know, it's the same thing with mm-hmm. actors. I mean, of course you're going to create characters that are not yourself, but you have to use sort of, if you're going any kind of method approach at all, you're using pieces of yourself starting from somewhere. So I just felt like I was just really drawn to extremeness and roles that mm-hmm. were not being, you know, offered to audition for TV and film in the early 80s that were, quote, normal. So I was mm-hmm. doing much better going up for roles that were, like, whacked out and crazy because that's what I related to, and I didn't even know it. So it kind of just came together. Like, yeah, I was a fan of horror movies, but at the same time, it was just creatively it gelled a lot more because the roles were just crazier and better for women in horror than they were in comedy, the straight films, the dramas and all this stuff. You know, very limiting. It was really all about the guys. So if you were to ask me, you know, favorite influences from the 70s and 80s, I would, 9 out of 10 would be men, because that
really
the roles, not because they're men, but the roles they had were the cool roles. You know what I mean? It was very hard to pick out cool roles that women had during that time period.
Okay. Do any of those influences particularly come to mind right now? When you say some of them were, you know, were a lot of them were guys. Any in particular that spring to mind?
Oh, yeah, and really I'm talking more about roles, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So what are the roles that really, you know, make me, you know, my mind blow? Like, okay, so, you know, everything from Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, I would say, you know, the cult movie The Warriors was a big influence on me. I would mm-hmm. say Clockwork Orange, I would say, you know, all of these great male roles. I would say, you know, The Thing, Escape from New York, all of the, like, cool roles, so to speak, or the edgy roles, something that was different, and it wasn't just you're on someone's arm. You know, you're the actual, you know, motivation or the angst or even the bad guy, if you will. You're, you know, any one of these with a really strong position in the film of some kind, even if it's a bad one, right? It was like all the guys had that, and then the girls were sort of like arm candy and such. So very uninteresting to me. So, and that's why,
Yeah, cool. So you know what? So then I guess, what was the first one? Obviously, I see what you're saying. You know, you got the Snake Plissken's and obviously the Travis Bickle's. These are all really interesting characters. What was the first time that you saw a female role that really kind of made you go, bam, that's what I'd love to do. That's an inspiring role.
Well, you know, probably something super obvious like Sigourney Weaver in Alien. Probably something like that, really. I mean, that would be, I'd be really hard-pressed to give you a laundry list from that time, you know, not this one. And so I would say they really didn't exist for the most part. You had your exceptions. So if you say something like that, there'll be all these people with their hands up. But what about, you know, blankety blank? Yeah, there's like one or two or three. You know, Barbara Steele is a great example of a strong female horror actress. You know, they do exist, you know. The Bette Davises, if you want to go back in time, but you know they weren't the common. And when I was coming up, what was in the culture then, the pop culture, was not like the classics like Bette Davis. You know, yeah, Barbara Steele for sure, but you know it was really really hard to find something during that particular period of time. It was a guy's world, and I love the guy's role. So. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, they were awesome. They were awesome. They just, you know, so that's why when people are like, okay, well, name your female influences. And I would say, well, you know, I definitely have them, and I have more maybe now today, but coming up, I had to make them up in my head. Like I had to become something different. Does that make sense? I had to become something on not anything in particular, you know.
Yeah, I hear you. And what you're saying makes all the sense in the world because, like, you know, again, when you say people jump up and say, well, no, what about this person and that person? Yeah, there were strong female roles, but like you say, they were more the exceptions that proved the rule. So, I know what you're saying exactly. And you did on your journey, you obviously, you know, you did, as you said, you did a lot of extra work. You did a lot of theater work in the early 80s there. What was the point where you kind of, the light bulb went off and you felt like, wow, I've not necessarily made it, but I'm on the right path to where I want to be. When did you get that feeling?
Well, you know, it's funny because, like, it's when you have that kind of, like, laser focus, there's not really a point. Like, you are just going along and you're doing better and better. You know, you're having some setbacks here and there, as any artist does, but you're doing better and better. And so it's very weird because your laser focus is so honed in that you don't even really completely notice. You're not like, oh my God, okay, that's great. Like you're not even giving yourself that benefit really, if that makes sense. I guess like looking back, I could say, okay, maybe it's a little bit easier to say looking back. But in 94, when I was one of the leads in a movie, which for me was a big deal, like it was a $1 million movie, it wasn't a tiny budget movie. And that's a small budget, but you know what I mean, comparative to a $100,000 budget movie. Yeah. It was $1 million. Yeah. It was, you know, back in Canada and, you know, Dan Haggerty, Grizzly Adams and, you know, John Michael Vincent, all these guys and Abducted 2. So that was like a moment, even if the movie didn't turn out how I thought it was going to, didn't matter. Like that was amazing. I had my own umbrella boy. So, I mean, that's a point where you're like, well, this is, you know, things are going well, I guess. I have an umbrella boy. So, I mean, like, you know, because it was a lot of raining on the mountains where we were shooting. So I was like, okay, there you go. There's a, you know, a moment in time there. Then, weirdly enough, I had been friends with Gunnar Hansen for a long time at this point.
Oh,
but I had made a movie with him in
98.
Like all through the early 90s, we used to like see each other. We used to write like handwritten letters, of course, back then to each other. Like he was in Maine, I was in New York. So just write letters, just friendly letters. And finally in 98, we did Hellblock 13, the first of a number of movies I did with him, but it was the first one. And I did have a moment where I said to myself, you know, it's so nice to be able to finally make this movie with Gunnar because we were always saying, oh, we need to make a movie and da da da. And I said to myself, just kind of out of nowhere, if I die tomorrow, where I came from on the street as a street kid, and I just finished making a movie with a great friend of mine and a horror, who happens to be a horror icon, if something happens to me tomorrow, I would be very proud of myself that I went from there to there. And this is in 1998. So, I mean, that was a real moment. I was like, everything else is gravy because I work so hard and I could say that I, even just to me, and nobody else cares. But to me, I could say I went from A to B and, you know, that's a beautiful thing. So for me, and so, you know, I was like, okay, everything else is gravy. And then, of course, I went on and my goals and all that, you know, went on and on. And so I passed that threshold, if you will, or that thought process, still feel that way. But, you know, and now if you were to talk to me, there's so much I need to get done, especially, you know, once you realize time is what it is, when you get a certain age, then you're really like, oh, my God, okay, let me get this shit done. Let me get all this shit done. I want to get done. I got, like, really got to, like, you know, hammer at it now. Like, come on. But so those are a couple of moments, I guess you could say, where, you know, just for me personally, you know, it meant something. And for an outsider looking in, it would be like, well, that's kind of, you know, either that's really cool or that's really lame. Doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks. It was sort of a real moment for me.
And you know what? You're right. It really doesn't matter what anyone thinks. For me, sitting here now, hearing you telling stories about trading notes with Gunnar Hansen, I got to tell you, like, I'm having a total, like, nerdgasm. It's amazing to me. Like, that's like,
and
wow.
And you know what? That's the fun of it, isn't it? Like, if you can't talk about that and, quote, admit that, like, what the hell are we all doing? Because that's, like, that's why I got into horror. And when I first started going to the conventions and all this kind of stuff, it was because it was damn exciting. And then, you know, before everybody wanted to just, like, break everybody down and all this crap. And that kind of stuff always existed, but there was always this little bit of a fantasy and funness and excitement in dealing with people. And you never ever took that for granted. And it was just like, it had that extra kick to it that was super, super nice. And you know what? If we can't enjoy ourselves in the journey, then what do we have? I encourage you and I'm happy.
You have, really. And honestly, you know, there's a part of me doing this because, you know, Debbie, we're roughly the same. We're around the same age, you and I. And I really am in my infancy at this point where I'm actually getting to speak to the people that have been inspirational to me over the years. So there's a part of me that says, you know what, I don't want to come across like the fanboy. But you know what, at the same time, I don't want to lose that. Because like you said, if we don't have that, what have we got? Just be honest. Just be open. Just be you.
Authentically you, uniquely you. And that is how you make your mark, not by trying to be either like someone else or not yourself. I mean, if you look at any actor that you love, like that any of you guys love, right? What do they have? Okay, they are uniquely themselves. They're not like anybody else. And anybody who's tried to be like them have failed, right? So this is the only way we can make any sort of artistic mark in whatever field we do is if we're authentically ourselves. That's the only way.
Yeah.
So,
agreed.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. And you know what? Nobody in the indie world anyway, you know, I'm not talking about the superhero world, but in the indie world, nobody is living in five different mansions at once. So if we are not enjoying ourselves, what the hell are we doing?
Right. Absolutely.
Right? I mean, 100%. That's like,
By the way, if I can interrupt for a moment, about the indie world, being a producer, I'm also on the PM, and somebody said hello to you while I was PMing in, and that would be, hold on just a moment here, that would be Tim. Tim Ritter said hello.
Jim, how is Jim? Jim is awesome. I mean, we made a quite a few movies together.
Tim actually he'll be on my show tomorrow, and I'll tell you someone else who said hello to you. I'll tell you someone else. We had him on a couple weeks ago. It was Joel Weinkoop. And you're actually doing a couple of films.
Yes,
so we're
yes.
very, very much connected with the indie world here.
Yes,
very much.
Very much. I mean, Joel is so great. He has been, you want to talk about, in the early 90s when I first came across his name, he was out there in Florida and he was doing his thing and he was, you know, working for a number of like the indie guys like that were who really pioneered shooting on video, by the way. Like they were the Kevin Lindenmuth. I mean, we're talking about the first guys to get movies made, shot on video, not film. It was so sacrilegious and wrong. And they were out there and they were still doing it. So they're truly the pioneers of this stuff.
Wow.
And this is obviously before it became super nice looking, right? It was like raw, raw.
Mm-hmm.
And Joel was out there literally in the marshes of Florida. I remember some scenes that he did. And so he's right in there with the pioneers. Like, you know, he's been.
Oh, yeah, they are the pioneers. No question at all.
Yeah, yeah. And Jim O'Rear, he has made so many cool movies, and he's invited me to come along for the ride. So I always have nothing but admiration for Jim, and I love Jim. He's been a super good friend, and there are, like, you know, if you find them in the business, you have to hold on to them because there's all different kinds of people in the business because the business attracts creatives, artists, people that are insanely talented, people that are incredibly supportive. It also attracts egomaniacs, people who are just doing it for power or all the wrong reasons, not the opposite of artistic. And I'm not being negative. I'm just being honest. And so because you have, like, equal amounts of both, when you have the people that are good, you keep them around. And that's why you keep seeing people, whether it be in Hollywood movies or indie movies, they will work with the same people over and over and over because they don't want to deal with the other, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and
actually,
it's
Debbie,
nice. You make your own family.
Absolutely. Sorry, just to pick up on, I agree. And just to pick up on something you said there, because you said, I'm not trying to be negative. And I honestly don't want to be negative, but at the same time, I am, you know, really looking to, you know, speak to the women out there that are listening to this and are gaining inspiration from figures like yourself there that have walked that walk. Was there ever a point, I mean, 250 plus movies, was there ever a point on your journey, either before you kind of became successful or after, that you felt like, you know, giving up? Anything along that way?
A million times. A million trillion times all along the way. Because at every point before things get, you know, but you never know what's, here's the thing, like just to cut to the chase here about how I kind of would come through that, right? Like it's the bottom line that people really need to hear. Okay, so many, many, many times I have felt that way. Thing went, like, really wrong, or I was treated so badly. This is way before the Me Too thing. Like, you know, just horrible stuff going on. And I was just like, F it, don't need it, you know. Then I would, at the end of the day, I would turn around and say, well, they're taking my art, and I'm not going to let them do that either. Like, you know, and I would come back around. But that, besides that struggle through the really crappy times and experiences between the really great ones, here's the thing. You hang in with this in mind. You never know if you keep putting in the work. That's the key right there. And I'm not talking about just, you know, meeting people on social media. While that seems to be very important nowadays, that's not the work. That's just a sideline to the work. You put in the work, and here's the key to keep in your mind when things are super dark. You do not know what's around the corner. And very often, that is going to be something really cool that you would kick yourself in hindsight if you didn't end up hanging in there and getting that job or that experience, whatever that creative thing may be, you never would have gotten that, and it will turn out to be one of the best experiences that you had. And you think back and say, wow, I almost like shit canned the whole thing. And, you know, and I hung on, and right around that next damn corner, I'm telling you, you can't see when it's coming. So you hang on. But on the other side, too, and this hasn't been my story, but at least as of right now, but the other side of it, too, is for some people, they're happier when they do quit. There's no bad thoughts. There's nothing bad about changing careers either. So you can't feel like, oh, I'm a failure because I'm leaving this, or, you know, I don't feel like I can take it, or it's not agreeing with my soul. Like, there's all of those elements too. And I think there's never, ever a bad thing or bad process that can make you actually leave something and that you were wrong. You're not wrong. That's not wrong either, by the way. But overall, the people, the lifers know that they're lifers deep, way deep down. And so they have to just say to themselves, this sucks so hard, but I'm telling you, I'm keeping working. And right around that damn corner is going to be something else. And even though I took like 5 hits in a row, I don't know what's next, and it could be the coolest thing ever, and very often it is. So,
And it's funny because, you know, like you say there, you know, you go through, and we all do. It's not just, you know, people in the movie industry. It's paramedics. It's, you know, people in any line of work. You go through sometimes the shittiest things, and you're like, I don't know. Why is this happening to me? What? And then years later, you'll identify the lesson that you learned from that. Nothing happens for bad reasons, ultimately. I honestly believe that. And you know what? Speaking of high points, actually, going in that positive kind of direction there, what do you consider, like, was your personal, for you so far? Because like you said, we never know what's around the next corner, right? What is your personal high point to now, to this day?
Now, are you talking about perhaps acting?
Anything. What do you feel like
anything
spiritually,
at all?
Yourself? Yeah, what is your personal high point?
Yes, I completely understand. So, okay, my personal high points, well, it was very interesting. American Nightmare, the movie, always jumps out, and the reason is because I had just gone through something really deeply traumatic emotionally, personally, just prior to it. And John Keyes kind of called me out of the blue and said he had wanted to do this female serial killer movie. And I had been writing for a local magazine down in Texas that he was doing, so we knew each other by that way. And so I went and I did that part, and there was so much of it that was improvised, and I was using so much of stuff that was going on with me. And I really saw, like, okay, well, when you know a character just so deeply inside and out, and you're lucky enough to be working with somebody who lets you improvise, you can really take this stuff to like a whole nother level. And you have to put in, obviously, the work, but if you do and you get to improvise because you know so well this person inside and out, that's really where the true joy, like you it was like probably the first time that I was like, wow, okay, I really like kicked it up. I experienced a kick up of what the joy of doing this stuff is. And, okay, so that was one point. There's another point where, you know, in my writing, I will just say to myself, you know, wow, like, I really, really, I never would have known, even though I've done it for so long, I never knew just how much I really love it until I've just been immersed in writing my book that I'm writing now, right? And then another just random thing is, like, you know, if you get the right director material. You've completely immersed yourself in the situation of the character, and you get to do something really kick-ass, and it's based on, like, a classic in the horror world writer. When I did Color from the Dark, based on Color from Outer Space. I mean, that was
H.P. Lovecraft.
Really powerful. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And
yeah.
it was just like,
wow.
There are these moments where you just, when you walk away and you feel in the best way, like completely used, like there was nothing that you left on the table. Like you
yeah.
put it all in and then some, and you walk away and you're, in a good way, I mean, completely empty. And,
wow.
you know, that was like one of those experiences again, you know, and there's been a few of them, but they're not always easy to come by because people don't have a number of things going. They don't have the money to have a shoot that'll be 4 or 5 weeks. They don't have, understandable, they don't have, maybe the material isn't, you know, quite, you know, amazing enough. And there's like a whole bunch of things that have to fall into place. That's why they do like of 250, 60 credits. I could probably tell you 10 where I felt like everything really damn fell in place. You know what I mean? It just,
yeah,
for
yeah,
whatever
absolutely.
Crazy reason that you can't even plan it. It's just like literally now play on words, the planets aligned. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they just, it just all comes together. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And American Nightmare, it should be noted for anyone listening to that, you won an award for that, right, in 2002 as the best female psycho.
Yeah, yes, I did. Yes, I did.
Amazing.
And that means a very lot to me because my friend who was the editor and publisher of Videoscope magazine who gave me that honor just passed away a couple months ago and the magazine ended. So, but that was like such an honor because it was before a lot of the indie people were, you know, really getting their movies in the film festivals, before there was even a lot of indie film festivals that existed for horror because it wasn't, they almost didn't exist at all, like for horror, especially indie horror. So,
yeah, for sure.
Prior to the massive amount that we have now, which is like a couple a month for the whole year, like, you know, but now it's virtual, but you know, now you could really get your movie out there and get it seen and get some awards and some attention. But yeah, so that was super cool because that wasn't even the case back then. It was released in 2002, shot in 2000. And ironically, we're working on the 20th anniversary limited Blu-ray release right now. So 20 years ago. Can you believe it?
That's good crazy. Boy. Hey, where does the time go? Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
yeah. But you, to pick up on your writing, your writing, I'm going to say that twice because every time I seem to say that, my accent, people think I'm saying writing. Writing. Your writing career. You said you're obviously working on a book. And you had a column there which really makes me jealous, for Fangoria, which is amazing. I'm going to ask you, because I say that you and I are kind of, we're from what I call the Fangoria generation. I feel sorry for some of the kids now where everything's online, and that's super cool, but they'll never understand the joy of going in, like when we would pick up Fangoria or Starlog to find out what was going on in movies. And I can remember the very first cover of Fangoria that I ever saw as a kid. I'll tell you mine in a second. I'm going to ask you first. Do you remember your first Fangoria cover that you ever saw?
Well, you know, it's going to be very self-serving because it was so amazing for me at the time, right? That's why. So I have to like say that part, but it doesn't sound like I'm putting this out there for all the wrong reasons, you know, bad reasons. Okay, there was a couple before this one, but I really didn't remember them because they were very similar to me. So they didn't jump out. The first one that was like had a massive impact on me was when they did the special edition. It was Jack Nicholson, and he was on there for Dracula.
Oh, wow. Jack Nicholson
so
on there for
Dracula. Yeah, it was like a special edition, a Dracula,
okay.
Like it's all vampires. And the reason, like I was, it was the very first time I was in Fangoria, like from a movie I did, 92, about an indie movie about vampires. And so
okay.
That when Jack Nicholson was on the cover, and I was like, oh my God, like this is absolutely incredible for the first U.S. magazine that I've ever been in. So I'd been in the U.K., but you know, this was like pretty amazing. It was Fangoria, but it was Jack Nicholson on the cover. So, like, wow, being something that had Jack Nicholson on the cover was damn cool. Like, so that was 1992.
Okay, that's amazing. That yeah, I mean that yeah, I could totally see the coolness there. For me, the first because obviously I haven't been in Fangoria. I hope I will be one day if they see fit.
Yes, you will. Yes, you will.
I hope so. But the first cover that I tell you, ever jumped out at me, I remember being a kid in the UK and going in, and it was Angus Scrimm for Phantasm. And I just couldn't believe it. Picking that cover up. Oh, yeah. I just couldn't believe it. And I just feel sad that kids just will never know that kind of what we knew there. But, you know, whatever. I guess it is what it is, right? Question about
yeah, but, you know, in all fairness, though, I was not – before I got into the horror world, I didn't know the horror world. I only knew what I watched movie-wise, like, you know, old Hammer movies and stuff on TV, perhaps. And, you know, I missed a whole chunk of time where I was, like, living on the street. So I wasn't going to shops and such. So by the time I saw that particular Fangoria, it's like that I was like involved in that world, and I went to Forbidden Planet in New York City, but I know they have one in the UK, and
yep.
You know, that's how and where I saw it. So it wasn't as though I was you know, in a town or had the type of lifestyle where I could casually walk in a magazine store and see things when I was as a teen, because I was just trying to survive through that time. So it kind of got delayed a little bit from me than from you, for example.
Yeah, and that's no, I completely understand. Well, I'm not, no, you know what, that's actually wrong. I don't understand because I've never walked in those shoes. But I damn impressive for what you did and what you built for yourself. And you certainly made up for lost time, for what you didn't experience in horror earlier by giving it back to us in the years that came. And I actually want to throw the ball back to Carl, because I know that Carl wanted to speak about one of your pieces that he absolutely adores. You know it's your turn, Carl. Go for it.
Okay, cool. First off, for our listeners, if you're wondering about the vampire film that Debbie was in 1992, that would be Valerie, a.k.a. Blood Dreams. Am I correct on that, Debbie?
You're correct on Valerie. If it was renamed, I have no idea. So you could be correct on both things, but I do not know.
Yeah,
it was
originally Sangra Songas for European, and then it was Valerie rather than the preferred title, Blood Dreams. But the one I want to talk about, now when Limes got you on board and so on and so forth, I was going through and I knew your name and I know I've seen you. But there's one particular film, and it's an anthology film, and it's what I consider one of the best horror anthologies of the aughts. And that's Theater Bazaar. And you worked actually with Tom Savini on that, on Wet Dreams. So I just wanted to let you know that, A, you blew me away in that movie. You were just so friggin' good. But also, Tom's a friend of the podcast. We've never had him on, but I'm originally from Pittsburgh. So you know, and I've talked to him a number of times. But I just wondered what it was like, you know, doing that particular segment, how that came along, and how it was working with Tom, with everyone there.
Oh, boy. Yeah, you know, I had known Tom for a long time. It's kind of like the Gunner situation, really, because it wasn't like, as you know, conventions are now, which are just basically corporate entities. They were far more, you know, much more casual, people getting together and have, you know, a handful of celebrities come and hang out with you. I mean, excuse me, that was really what it was. And so I knew Tom because there was a few other things I'd worked on that he had either been involved with or associated with, and I was very close with all the guys from Night of the Living Dead, the original. So, and he was, of course. I even bought a house in Pittsburgh for a while. I didn't live there long, but it was close to where Tom has his house. So, I mean, like, there was a lot of, like, East Coast, a lot of the people on the East Coast would know each other, I guess is what I'm saying. So when his short came along that he was doing for this particular Severn Films Theater Bazaar production, his producers for the movie had called me and said, you know, they'd all wanted me for the lead in this and would I be interested in doing it. And I was like, oh, with Tom, are you kidding me? It's done, you know, no problem, of course. And so when I got down there, Tom was so, so easy to work with. It was ridiculous. It was just, you know, he was just so cool, so nice. He was, you know, he would help with the effects if there needed to be helped, of course. But, you know, in other words, he wasn't above anything. Like, you know, and he really trusted his actors. When they hired the young actor who played my husband in the movie, this is one thing I did think was very funny as sort of a side funny note. He was way deep into the method. You know, he was from Montreal. And he came down to do the movie. And he was really deep in the method. And so when the point in the short where I take his arms and legs off and have him upstairs there, sort of tied down and torturing him, he wanted to feel like he didn't have his limbs. And so he was doing his method work downstairs, and it was being shot in the attic where they set up the attic with all that stuff in the scene. And so the mm-hmm. crew had to actually carry him up a ladder, like the type of like rickety ladder, not a staircase, that would go up into an attic. They had to carry him up there because he didn't want to lose that feeling from his method preparation. And I'm not putting the guy down in the story. It's just a funny story. You know what I mean? It is what it is. It's a funny story. These poor crew guys had to, like, carry him up as he stayed, like, super limp so that he could hold on to his, you know, acting method. And, you know, God bless him for being that committed. But I was like, oh, my God, I could never put these crew guys through this stuff. That was so bad. I felt so bad
good
for
Lord.
Them. But Tom, great, you know, what an attitude. He was like, okay, then carry him up. Like, he was just like, you know.
Jeez.
He was very, very relaxed and completely in charge, you know. Great guy.
Talk about suffering for your art. I mean, like, God.
No, the actor wasn't suffering. It was the goddamn crew people.
Exactly. I know. I think the crew people were feeling more like the character at that point than perhaps he was. But, you know, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? He did what he thought he had to do. But this is, you know, very. You see this a lot with actors who, like, really immerse themselves in acting class, and they first get out of acting class. You know, they really want that perfect, you know, experience, like they had an acting class, which never exists on movie sets. I remember when I did that myself, like that type of thing. It was a movie called Lonely in America, and I had a small role in it, but I wanted to do this exercise that I had been, like, doing endlessly in acting class, and I did do it. And, you know, it wasn't the same thing as what he did. Like, it didn't cause anybody physical harm. But It was, you learn the hard way. Like for as many times as early on as I missed the mark, you know, like you say, you learn from it. You learn from it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And speaking of learning, you know, there's a lot of obviously young women out there now that are listening to the show that are at that point, you know, as we once were, where we were, you know, sort of watching the horror and thinking, you know, there's going to come a day that I want to be on that path. I want to go from viewer to creator. What do you say to those girls that are listening to you and being inspired by you right now, Debbie?
To go from viewer to creator? Well, you know.
Yeah, if they want to get in the career, thing, yeah.
Yeah. So, well, the thing is, it's everything is so advanced that it's if you're willing to put the work in, there's just nothing stopping you. Because you can edit on your computer. You could shoot with almost anything. Like, you could get a really nice camera if you have the money, definitely. But if you don't, you could still shoot with anything. You can learn lighting, or you can bring someone in who knows some lighting. You could, again, sound editing. There's a lot of musicians out there struggling as well. You might be able to get some sound cues for free from them. You know what I mean? There's just, in other words, if you're willing to put the work in, and it is work as far as time and commitment and patience, you can absolutely do it. Like, there's nothing that's stopping you, because you could write it and shoot it and edit it, and you can get people to help you too. But they're just technologically speaking, there's absolutely nothing stopping you anymore. Not like there was, oh, all these things stopping me. But when I started, everything was shot on film. So you did have to be able to raise a lot of money. You did have to hire a DP that knew everything forwards and backwards about actual film. You did have to hire an editor that physically spliced the film. Like, so there was this certain things that some directors knew how to do, but it was a very different thing. So just, you know, I could say the same to myself or anybody who has never done anything yet, but they are going to. There's just nothing stopping you but you. And that's really it's really that simple nowadays. If you put in the work, you right there, that's it. You can do it. If you're willing to put in the work,
if I can interrupt, I just want to say, Debbie, we have a series. We're connected with a Facebook group called Incredibly Strange Films. We have 300,000 members plus, but our series of podcasts are all with independent directors and people like Mark Pirro, who has shot a movie for $500. But he was able, he's been working with people and so on and so forth. It's a matter of surrounding yourself with people with the same vision and just letting them do it and you do it and just get it done. It can get done. No question at all.
Yep.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. And that's why, going back to the other point too, you find people that work well with you and, you know, and that's it. And the only thing I will add, this is not, again, you know, I keep giving disclaimers as though I'm not allowed to have an opinion, but I don't mean it that way, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Going to the not being negative but thing again, what you will find, though, too, is you will find people that while you have nothing or they have nothing and you've been so kind to give your time to assist them, when, in fact, you know, you may get a lot more payment or a lot more fill-in-the-blank elsewhere on different projects, but because you have come in because you really want to help somebody from the trueness of your artistic side, they can turn around, and as soon as they do get some money, they will hire, like, a completely different set of people. They don't bring people along. So you will also find through hardships, who your family is, like who will actually bring you along because you did them a good turn. And it's not like you would fit in every movie that came along, so you don't need to get twisted about that. But if in general, that if people sort of bring you along, you're in the sphere of, you know, working with people and such. So there's that too, but that's all part of the process of finding out who your sort of clan is, if you know what I mean. Me, I'm both clan, but I'm way more lone wolf. Like, I'm so lone wolf. I've not been on the inside. I have not been an ass kisser. I have not been sleep with somebody for a role or have a spouse or boyfriend in the business, you know, that gets me role. I have not been any of those things. That's not a judgment on anybody who is those things. But I've always acknowledged the fact that I am a lone wolf. That's okay. I could be a part of your clan. It could be temporary or permanent. That's okay too. But you have to be completely independent in that sense, because not everybody's moral compass is going to exactly reflect yours. And that's okay. That's okay. Like, they can, like, zoom off and do their thing, but you've got to do yours. And that's going back to the other point, too. You have to stay unique and true to yourself. Because as soon as you start imitating others, that's when you just become forgettable. And that's not the point of being any kind of artist, right? Whether you're doing a podcast or directing or acting or anything.
Exactly. And speaking of podcasts, tell us about your podcast, Debbie, because you've got a podcast, Obscurities, right? Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. Oh, I do. And, yeah, I would love people to check it out. It's a new podcast in the sense that, well, it's been going on since October, but because it's a narrative, it's not like an interview show where everything's sort of, it's in an interview show, you're preparing, of course, but it's different than just doing a straight up narrative on any particular subject matter. So they come out like maybe once a month, and next will be every 2 weeks, perhaps. So, but that takes some time. So it's sort of dealing with, like, strange events that it's kind of up to you to believe, not believe. It shows you both sides. It's not just showing you one particular side, like the whole, thought process behind El Chupacabra, for example, or aliens, for example, or, spirits, for example, or sometimes it's just weird history, because it's really kind of falling into strange history category, like North Brother Island, which is like really an intense episode, because it's all these things that happen on this island, and like just none of them turned out good. It's this tiny island just right off of Manhattan, but it just had like the luck of like shit, like just not the only way to say it. This, you know, this everything. Typhoid Mary was there. You know, she ended up there. She, you know, it was craziness. But yeah, I would love people to check it out, and if you like it, please subscribe. As you guys know, it's very helpful, and it just really, you know, assists in getting the podcast out there. You guys know very well that's like half the battle, just to get it in front of people and get people to stream it and hopefully enjoy it. So thank you for bringing it up. They can get the links right off DebbieRochon.com or my Facebook or pretty much anywhere, but, you know, all my links are always on DebbieRochon.com.
Be sure to give us that info. Be sure to give us that info, Debbie, and we'll get it on DBA's Legion also.
I'll be blasting that out on iScreams as well, and Carl will be doing it on Deviant Legion, absolutely. And it sounds exactly like the type of podcast that I want to listen to myself, because that's really my kind of bag. I love listening to that kind of thing. That's mysteries, UFOs, you name it, I'm there. So
And it doesn't tell you. Sorry, I'll just end with this though. It doesn't tell you how to feel. In other words, it's not trying to get you to think that these conspiracies are true or not true. It's just some facts, and then you kind of make up your own mind. But anyway, yeah.
No, that's great. That's perfect. That's what you want, right? And now, obviously, we're going to be going over to Carl to do his housekeeping in a second, because I know for a fact, and I want to let the viewers know this, you have a very early morning tomorrow. So it is absolutely – we thank you so much for taking time out to do this with us, to come on here tonight, Debbie, because that's amazing.
Absolutely.
Really is.
And, Debbie, before I do what we call housekeeping here, is there any films or anything, any other projects that we should be looking forward to of yours that's coming out?
Yeah, you know, there really is. And here's the issue with since COVID-19, a lot of stuff has kind of been thrown up in the air. But
there's
a movie called Freak. Yeah, Freak by Bianca Crespo that should be coming out pretty soon. There is, like I say, The American Nightmare 20th Anniversary. I don't know what time this year, what month I should say, because of COVID sort of thrown that up in the air at the same time. There's a couple movies like, for example, Killer Babes and the Frightening Film Fiasco. That's made by the same director who made Bloody Ballet. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff, but right now, probably till the middle of the year, to be honest with you, I'm not entirely sure when things are going to be, you know, having actual dates assigned to them.
Yeah, for sure.
Right,
yeah.
I know. We talked to Joel a couple weeks ago, and I do know that Beast Mode and Craiglon Incident, he said both of those should be out this year. He's hoping they're going to be out.
Very good.
Yeah, so definitely we want to keep those in front of people and let them know it's coming. I'm just impressed beyond belief, Debbie. Thank you so much for being on with us. Limes, why don't you see her out, and then we'll get into what else is going on in DB Legion.
Yeah, Debbie, I got to tell you, I know Carl always says to me, you know, like, don't do the fanboy thing. Don't be the fanboy. But I got to tell you, like, I don't give
you know what?
I
be the fanboy. I'll allow you today. It's okay.
I am grinning from ear to ear on this end. This has been a wonderful hour. And honestly, you've given, like, I'm feeling inspired. Just listening to you, this is absolutely awesome. So thank you more than anything for the energy that you've brought to the show tonight. And, you know, you come back anytime, and I hope we can stay in touch, okay?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, awesome. Just really before I go, I just want to thank you really damn sincerely for having me on. It was a great time. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome, Debbie.
Absolutely.
All right, so right now we're into housekeeping. And so what we're going to do now is talk about what we've got coming up. On Tuesday, we have the ISF podcast with Tim Ritter. And Tim will be talking about his films. We'll be getting into specifically, you know, the old DIY direct-to-video stuff and how he started that along with a number of people. And we're going into that and how to direct and produce a film for no money. So we'll be doing that on Tuesday. On Friday, I will be doing Carl's Cavern. And I'm doing a very special personal show on that one. It's Memories of a Music Store, and that would be my music store called McKean Music back in the 80s and 90s. I have a bunch of people that will be coming on that are former customers. Also, one of my former customers is one of the premier up-and-coming blues guitarists in the country. His name is Jeff Betterman. We also have another gentleman by the name of Gene Johnson. Gene is an author, we'll be talking about how it's kind of cool to hang out in a music store, okay? And then on Saturday, Doc and I will be doing Scratch's Sleaze Box, and we'll be doing a commentary watch on the Cane Toad documentary. Hopefully we'll be able to get director Joe Badon on that. I still haven't heard from Joe specifically. That's basically what we have set up. Now, you've got a show coming in 2 weeks, Ron, so why don't you talk about that show?
Absolutely, yes. Obviously, you know, the Women in Horror theme that we've been running with this month, we are going to have another legend of both science fiction, horror, and movies in general. We are going to have Dee Wallace, who many of you know from E.T. and Cujo and The Howling and so many great movies from the sort of 80s, 70s, 80s, and 90s there. The Hills Have Eyes, it just goes on and on. So Dee's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks. I'm also going to be having a conversation shortly with Stacey Nelkin, who you know as Ellie Grimbridge from Halloween 3 and was the fifth replicant that was to be in Blade Runner. She's going to be speaking with us soon. And towards the end of the let's just leave that there for now. That's great. That's what's on the boiler for me at the moment.
Yeah, and let me know when Stacey is set up because I'd like to be in on that one.
You got it.
And that'll be great. We want to thank everyone for joining us today. And again, a great nod of appreciation to Debbie Rochon for joining us today.
Debbie
Rochon. She was awesome, Ron. You outdid yourself, my friend.
Buddy, big salute. Wasn't she wonderful? Oh, my goodness.
Oh, absolutely.
That was great. What a fun
hour. Debbie, if you're still listening to this, I just want to say we love guests where you talk and talk and talk and we don't have to do anything. That's a wonderful thing.
Say goodnight, buddy.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us. Good night.
Good night. God bless. And see you all soon.